listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, Democrats in Wisconsin are hopeful after their party won in a deeply red state like Alabama. An expert tells us whether Wisconsin could ride a pro-democratic wave hitting parts of the country. Now, a long night's sleep can seem like a luxury, but it turns out that the time we spend asleep is as important to our bodies as eating well and exercising. And it's not your imagination if you think how, when, and how long you sleep has changed over the years. Matthew Walker is a professor of neuroscience and psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, and is the director of its Center for Human Sleep Science. He's a former professor of psychiatry at Harvard University, and his most recent book is Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams. Matthew, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's set the stage. What actually happens when we sleep?
Well, we used to think that sleep was largely a passive state where the body simply rested and the mind was dormant. And now we know nothing further from the truth could be happening here. The brain is incredibly and intensely active. In fact, during some stages of sleep, your brain is up to 30% more active than when you're awake. And that's critical for aspects of learning, memory, creativity. It also helps with emotional therapy. It provides a form of essentially emotional first aid. Downstairs in the body, we know that deep sleep actually offers one of the greatest forms of blood pressure medication that you could ever wish for. It also seems to recharge your immune system and refresh that immune system. It also overhauls aspects of our metabolism, things like our ability to regulate glucose to keep us away from a path of diabetes. And sleep also regulates our appetite hormones so that we don't overeat the next day, so that we feel satisfied with our food and that we're making the right choices in terms of what we eat.
I thought it was really interesting and really great the way you explained it, because I actually understood it, that our brain is actually, like every night, our brain is getting rid of stuff it doesn't need and building and strengthening things it does. So how does the brain do to what seem like very different and almost opposing activities?
It's fascinating, isn't it? So we've realized over the past 10 or 15 years that sleep after learning is essential to hit the save button on new memories so that you don't forget. So sleep in that way is really future-proofing the information within the brain. But we've recently learned that sleep is much more intelligent than we once gave it credit for. Sleep can actually identify things that perhaps you've already learned previously, and you don't need to create duplicate copies of. It's a little bit like sorting through a hard drive and weeding out the stuff that you don't need. And also sleep tries to prioritize information, so things that are perhaps especially salient and important to you, sleep will preferentially enhance those things. And those things that perhaps don't seem to be as emotionally necessary for you, sleep may even let go of. So sleep is clever in that way. It seems to have an elegant algorithm for informational storage. And it has to have that, by the way, because the brain doesn't have infinite storage capacity. It's a fixed storage system. So something has to stay, something has to go, and sleep seems to have a really quite clever equation for dictating what you remember and what you forget.
And so what happens if we don't give our brains a chance to do all that by getting good and consistent night's sleep? What happens to those important functions?
Well, certainly there are incredible deleterious health and disease consequences downstairs in the body, but upstairs in the brain, we know that if you're not getting enough sleep, firstly, your brain cannot commit new experiences to memory effectively. In other words, your brain can't learn efficiently. So it's almost as though the memory circuits of the brain become waterlogged and you can't absorb new information. We also know that there are certain parts of your brain, particularly the higher level rational regions of the brain, regions that we call the prefrontal cortex that sit just above your eyes. Those areas act like a very clever CEO of the brain. But when you're underslept, those regions seem to get taken offline, so you become much more impulsive, much more emotionally irrational. You become much more hot-headed. You're much more likely to snap in terms of your emotions. We also know that if you're not getting enough sleep, the brain is actually not detoxing itself of the metabolic byproducts that build up whilst we're awake during the day. Wakefulness essentially is a form of low-level brain damage, but one of the critical toxins that sleep washes away at night is a sticky protein called beta amyloid. And it is beta amyloid that seems to be one of the leading causes of Alzheimer's disease. And this is why we now have developed and found very strong, significant links between people who aren't getting enough sleep during their lifespan and marked increases in Alzheimer's risk later in life.
We're talking with Matthew Walker, a professor of neuroscience and psychology at UC Berkeley, about his most recent book, Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams. And Matthew, let's look across the life cycle and how our sleep needs change. And let's start with before birth. What does sleep have to do with fetal development?
It seems to have to do everything with fetal development, because in fact, almost 90% of the time that you are in utero developing, you are actually in some form of sleep. And it seems to be a particular type of sleep. It's a stage of sleep that we call rapid eye movement sleep, something that often is associated with dreaming. And it's that stage of sleep during that early developmental time in life that is actually acting almost like an electrical fertilizer for the central nervous system, particularly for the brain. So REM sleep at that time of life, it's a little bit like an internet service provider that has a whole new neighborhood of houses. And its job is to go in there and lay down all of that fiber optic cable for high-speed broadband connectivity. And it seems to sort of flourish and populate all of the different neighborhoods of the brain with this connectivity, and then actually ignite it with that high-speed broadband electrical connection activity. So sleep in utero is absolutely essential, and there were studies done back in the 1970s where they actually deprived young infant rats of that REM sleep, and it significantly blunted the developmental trajectory of brain structure. So I think it's a real warning for us as we see sleep time start to decrease across the lifespan, but particularly in younger adults.
So does that continue once a child is born in the first year of life, the first few years of life? Is sleep that important for development then as well?
It is. It is absolutely essential. And not just in humans, by the way. In every species that we've studied to date, sleep is in highest amounts early in life. It seems to be a universal feature of sleep and life on this planet. And we think it's exactly for that purpose. It's for the explosion of growth and development, both of the body, but also in particular those animals that have complex nervous systems. That's where we see sleep in highest amounts in those early stages of life, post-utero.
Well, let's move on to the age group that gets a lot of attention and grief about their sleep habits, teenagers. What is that shift that I think any of us who have been teenagers or have lived with teenagers have seen, where they stay up late, they want to sleep as long as possible, and they have a really hard time getting up?
Yeah, what is going on there? Well, there's really a collision of two factors, one that's natural and one that's artificial. The natural part of that equation is that once you go through that adolescent transition, there is a shift that happens in your 24-hour clock timing within the brain, and it forces you further forward in time, so you start to want to go to bed later and wake up later. So it's not teenagers being rebellious. It's not their fault. If you say, you know, get to bed, it's 9 or 10 o'clock at night, and they're still awake, you know, at 11 o'clock. It's just their biology, and it's a genetic predeterminant. It's not their fault. However much they would wish or will themselves to be asleep, it's not going to happen. So that's the first aspect, and that's very natural. We know that that happens. The artificial force, however, that often makes us think that teenagers are perhaps a little bit lazy, especially during weekends where they seem to sleep in or sleep too much. You know, it's that idea of a parent going into the teenager's room, you pull the covers off and you open the curtains and you say, look, you're wasting the day, it's midday. Well, part of that is due to that fast-forwarding in time of the 24-hour clock. But a much bigger part of that is that they are sleeping off a remarkable debt, a sleep debt, that we have lumbered them with this incessant model of early school start times during the week. Mm-hmm. And that has to change because it has marked deleterious consequences, both on their academic development, their grades, as well as their psychiatric and mental states, as well as their life expectancy when it comes to driving accidents as well. So that's the second part of that adolescent equation.
And finally, what about the elderly? There's a common belief that the elderly don't need as much sleep. Is that actually true?
Well, it's one of the myths that I actually debunk in the book, and I spend an entire chapter on this, Sleep Across the Lifespan. It's not true. We know that older adults seem to need just as much sleep in the 60s, 70s, and 80s as they did in the 40s. It's simply that the older adult brain is not capable of generating the sleep that it still necessarily needs. So it's a deficit in the ability to get the sleep rather than a reduction in the need for sleep.
And we'll talk about some of the things that can interfere with getting a good night's sleep in just a moment. We're talking with sleep researcher Matthew Walker about his new book, Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you feel guilty about sleeping a full 8 hours or maybe for taking a nap? Has how and how much you sleep changed as you've aged? And are you one of the millions of Americans with sleep problems? Call 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're continuing our conversation with Matthew Walker. He's a professor of neuroscience and psychology at UC Berkeley and the director of its Center for Human Sleep Science. His most recent book is Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams. And we want to hear from you. How well do you sleep? Have you found any tricks to help you get a good night's sleep? Or maybe you need some. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Matthew, you lay out a really convincing case for why adequate sleep is important, but what if it eludes us? There are a lot of people that have sleep problems. What should people do and what should they not do?
Well, I think beyond making sure that you carve out enough time to sleep, and right now the World Health Organization recommends an 8-hour sleep opportunity every night, there are probably 5 things that people can do to start to get better sleep. The first is regularity. Try to go to bed at the same time and wake up at the same time, no matter what. Sometimes people will make the mistake of sort of staying up late and then waking up late, particularly on the weekends. It's what we call social jet lag. And that sort of pulling forward and back of your body clock in time is really not great for your sleep. So keep it regular. The second is temperature. Keep your bedroom cool, probably cooler than you think. Around about 67, 68 degrees is optimal for most people. The reason is that your body needs to drop its core temperature to initiate sleep and stay asleep soundly. So you can help it do that by keeping the room cool. The next is darkness. We actually are a dark-deprived society in this modern age. And you need darkness at night to allow the release of a hormone that is called melatonin. And melatonin helps time the healthy onset of natural sleep. So perhaps in the last hour before bed, just shut off half the lights. You don't need all of the lights on. Stay away from LED screens. They are particularly damaging, and that's been demonstrated with research that that can block that release of melatonin in deleterious ways. The next thing is not to stay in bed awake for too long. So if you've been in bed, either falling asleep or if you've woken up and you're trying to get back to sleep, if you've been awake there for about 25 minutes, don't stay in bed is the advice, because your brain quickly learns the association between your bed being the place of being awake rather than being asleep.
And probably so being stressed about not being able to fall asleep.
Exactly, yeah. So you, and association is a powerful thing in that regard, just as you mentioned. So what you should really do is get up, go to a different room, and in dim light, maybe just read a book. Don't check emails. Don't try to eat. It creates a habit. And only return to bed when you're sleepy, and that way you will relearn the association between your bedroom being about the place of sleep. The final thing usually makes me deeply unpopular, which is that you should abstain from caffeine after about 2 p.m., and you should skip the nightcap. Now, when it comes to caffeine, everyone knows that caffeine is an alerting substance. It can keep you awake, keep you a little wired. What some people don't realize, however, is that even if you can have a cup of coffee at night and you can fall asleep and stay asleep, you won't get into the very deepest stages of sleep. It will be a lighter form of sleep that you get. So then you wake up the next day, you don't feel refreshed, and you find yourself reaching for two cups of coffee rather than one, and it becomes a dependency and addiction cycle. Alcohol, then, is perhaps the most misunderstood drug of all. Alcohol is a sedative, and sedation is not sleep. Mm. So what people mistake when they say, oh, I have a little drink, a little nightcap before bed, and it helps me fall asleep, all you're doing is actually knocking your brain out. You're not helping it get into natural sleep. And then there are two more problems with alcohol. Firstly, alcohol will fragment your sleep, so you will wake up many more times throughout the night. And then finally, alcohol is actually very effective at blocking one type of sleep called rapid eye movement sleep, dream sleep, that we spoke about before.
And I'm going to ask you to hold on there, Matthew, because we have several people who want to join the conversation. We're getting a little short on time. So let's go to the phones, and Kelly in Milwaukee is up first. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
It's not really a question. It's just my experience. You should say, I was fine falling asleep, never had a problem until I had a child. And I call it like momsomnia. Like any little thing you hear, like you're up, you're ready to go. It takes you like four sleeping pills a night to be able to just like get into bed.
All right. And Kelly, I want to give Matthew a chance to respond. Matthew, I know you write quite a bit about sleeping pills.
Yeah, I do. And this is not uncommon with young children. In fact, there's some studies where people have looked at how the brain, whilst it's asleep, responds to the name or the sound of that individual's child. And the brain seems to be on hyper alert even when you're asleep relative to other sounds. So it's a very real phenomenon. Sleeping pills are a concern. The book goes into detail. Those sleeping pills do not produce naturalistic sleep, and I'm not trying to shame anyone here, and if you have any questions, go and see your doctor, but those sleeping pills have also been related to a higher risk of death and cancer. People need not necessarily seek sleeping pills, because there is a behavioral non-drug alternative called cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, or CBTI. And I encourage people to either look at the chapter in the book on that, or just go onto the internet and search that term, and they should be able to find help.
Thanks for that call, Kelly. Let's go next to Katie in Eau Claire. Hi, Katie.
Hi there. So I recently had a baby, and I tried this with my daughter, but we've done the Ferberizing, or the cry it out method, and I've recently been reading a lot. Some people saying that it's good, some people saying that's bad, and I'm wondering what your guest take is on it.
All right. So, Matthew, for helping infants who are awake and crying, helping them get back to sleep so they can get that important sleep, what do you recommend?
Yeah, so the Ferberizing method created by a professor by that name is that sort of let the child cry it out treatment, and gradually, almost like sort of letting the rope out on a sailboat, it gradually sort of go longer and longer with the duration of time before you go back in to try and comfort the child. That does seem to have some degree of benefits. There are some studies demonstrating that. But I would also say that you should just be attuned to your child. And if you really feel as though after going through that process systematically that it just doesn't seem to be working, then it's not a one-size-fits-all, and you can look to the alternatives. And I think experts are great in that regard. You can try it. It is a proven method, but it isn't for everyone. So just be a wonderful mother in that sense and be attuned to what your child needs.
All right. Thanks for that call, Katie. And Ruth in Eau Claire says she recommends sleeping masks. Made a world of difference for her, but you need to get the right one. And you were talking about how important darkness is, Matthew. Is there something we should look for in a sleeping mask?
Sleeping masks can be useful. Some people find them a little bit uncomfortable. An alternative is actually just buying blackout curtains. They can actually be just as effective. Some people who are especially sort of morning types, they tend to like the light coming through to the curtains, and so they prefer non-blackout curtains. But if you are someone who is particularly light sensitive, and many of us are, you can certainly try those blackout curtains. They can be very beneficial.
And as we start to wrap up, Matthew, is it possible to sleep too much, either in one night, or if you're sleeping at night and then napping during the day? Can we sleep too much? Is there such a thing as too much of a good thing?
Well, there is something called hypersomnia, but we principally see that in depression. But even if you look at that data, it seems to be people may be reporting staying in bed too long rather than sleeping too long. So at present, we don't actually have strong evidence for this thing called too much sleep. Is there such a thing? I think it's potentially possible. Some people describe a sleep hangover when they oversleep. That's usually because they are chronically sleep deprived, and they try to oversleep and sleep off that debt.
Well, Matthew, thank you so much for joining us. Matthew Walker is a professor of neuroscience and psychology at UC Berkeley and the director of its Center for Human Sleep Science. His book is Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams. This is Central Time.